Hello and welcome to Main Street on this Monday. So glad to have you along. I'm Eric Detheridge, pinch hitting in the hosting chair for Craig Blumenschein all this week. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll share another story from Fargo's monthly live storytelling event, The Tell. It's a timely and seasonal tale, not about a turkey, but a different type of holiday bird and a rare one to find at your local grocery store. But first, you can get it if you really want. Vietnam, The Harder They Come, and Many Rivers to Cross. Just a few of the reggae hits from Jamaican legend Jimmy Cliff, who passed away at the age of 81. Along with Bob Marley, few artists propelled his country's biggest export into the collective consciousness of the world as Jimmy Cliff. For this month's Philosophical Currents, Jimmy and music in general is very much on the mind of our in-house philosopher. So as sure as the sun shine, I'm gonna get my share now, what's mine, and then the harder they come, the harder they'll fall, one and all.
We are blessed again to be joined by Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, my good friend and philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota and host of the public radio program Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. We're going to chat about the meaning of music, how it shapes our identity, and whether its role is evolving, especially in this digital age. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
I am happy to be here, but waking up to hear about Jimmy Cliff's death was not a nice way to start the day. They had just announced it about an hour before I looked at the internet, and he was, for me, a seminal figure in my sense of music, in my identity and how I expressed myself to the world. And his movie, The Harder They Come, which is a cornerstone of Jamaican cinema, is fused in my brain. And so I've been genuinely sad, as if I've lost someone who I have a real relationship with. And I suppose what we'll be talking about is the fact that I do.
Yeah. And when did it start for you, Jack? When did your relationship with him, and with Jimmy in particular, begin?
Well, I have a whole Why episode about ska and Jamaican music, and I offer a little bit of a biography, which I won't go into here, but the very short version is that I grew up in New York City in a very diverse place, the son of a jazz musician. Music was all around me, and I discovered this music called ska, which is the predecessor to reggae. And in the process of pulling that thread and finding a subculture, which we'll end up talking about, and a community, I discovered this album and this legendary movie, which, of course, I had on videotape, and I have the vinyl, and I still listen to the original vinyl. And the movie itself tells the story of a young musician from rural Jamaica who comes to the big city to become a pop star and gets walked all over and gets involved in gangsters and ends up in a shootout with the police. And in many ways, it's very cliche, but in many ways, it tells the story that we all know so well of being young and wanting to impose yourself on the world and insisting on getting an audience. And so the music itself, to the modern ear, would be very old-fashioned. It's of a very specific time and a very specific place. And the soundtrack has him and a bunch of other early ska musicians who will later be identified as reggae. And it's just always been there. I remember seeing, and this is also something that many listeners will not be able to identify with, I remember seeing it in a revival theater when I was 16. Back in New York, there were a couple theaters that would show old movies, right? We videotapes didn't have everything. We only had the networks, right? All that sort of stuff. And everyone who went to see this movie was a fan. And everyone who went to this movie knew all of the music. In fact, in one of my great moments of parenthood, Adina, my daughter, was in New York City last year, and they had a screening of a restored print of The Harder They Come from film. And I think she had never seen a movie on film before. And I asked her, did you recognize any of the songs? And she laughed and she said, every single one of them by heart. And so that's how ever present this particular period of Jimmy Cliff has been. Although I think most people might know him by the reggae version of the song I Can See Clearly Now that ended the movie Cool Runnings about the Jamaican bobsled team.
So what happens to us philosophically when a song or a movement becomes part of who we are? I sense, Jack, that he is a part of who you are, like you said earlier.
This is a really interesting discussion, and there's been a lot of work lately about why teens in particular become so attached to music and why, as we get older, it's much harder to find new music and new connections, right? I'm sure you are like me, in which the vast majority of stuff you listen to is stuff you've been listening to for 20, 30 years.
I try to listen to indie pop every now and then, but I always find my way back to the yacht rock station. Now, what does that say about me?
Well, I'm not here. I'm not in a position to judge. But what the neuroscientists are telling us is that the synapses and neurons that are being fired during our teen years, from about 11 and 12 to probably early college, are being created simultaneously with our discovery of this music. And so it literally becomes hardwired into us in some way. And we start to identify this music with particular memories, particular emotions, particular relationships and connections. We can feel the angst that we might have felt as a teenager, or the isolation or the loneliness, which I'll come back to in a second. We can remember the time and place. The very first concert, this is again for our generation, the very first concert I went to, and I went by myself, was I was in sixth grade, and there was a 16 and underage show at a club from the band Musical Youth, which was the Jamaican band that sang that song Pass the Dutchie. And I remember every single moment of that experience, from going, from being there, from the people that I met. And so the first thing is that we are created, we are developed, we are evolving alongside the music that we choose. Then intertwine that with the way we want to project to the world, the clothes we wear, the words we use, the friends we want to identify ourselves with. That gets wrapped up into it too, but I'll wait until we get to that.
Well, tell me, Jack, historically, and are there moments in philosophy where music is treated not just as art, but as a tool for forming self? And I think my next question becomes, is this more of a psychological connection, philosophical, historically relevant, or explain it more for us?
So the biggest moment in the history of philosophy is for music is Schopenhauer. And Schopenhauer is a 19th century German philosopher, an idealist, meaning he thought that the core of the universe was abstract, it was ideas. And he centers music, and I always sort of jokingly describe his philosophy the same way. I always say, life is terrible, it's pain, it's suffering, we are lost, nothing is ever going to happen to us that's good, but music is really nice. And what he's trying to do is come to grips with the thing that they just didn't have the ability to articulate back then, which was the way that our physical selves and the way that our imaginations are formed and intertwined with music. Now, music is ever present in culture, but music is also historically very disconnected from day-to-day life, because for most of human history, most people didn't own musical instruments. There was no records, there was no radio, you would hear traveling musicians play at festivals, you might hear choral music at church. Once they started to be able to mass produce the piano. People would have pianos in their homes, but you didn't have sheet music until around the late 19th and early 20th century. And that itself was a huge problem because the recording industry thought that sheet music was going to mean that everyone was going to steal their music and that everyone was going to violate their intellectual property. Every time there is a new technology for music, people freak out. So the intimate connection of artificially created noise that you and I take for granted is very, very new. Televisions, radios, hearing people on the news, the telephone, right? People had the sounds of the city. People had the sounds of cattle. People had lots of background, but to create, to design, to reproduce music is a very, very modern phenomenon. And so it's going to have a very different impact in the modern world than it would at any other time. And you see that particularly with teenagers in the 1950s. You see that with African Americans in the United States in the 1920s and 30s, the birth of jazz, the birth of popular music coming out of New Orleans and Louis Armstrong. But it becomes, you see swing movement and things like that, but it becomes a dominant part of the culture in the 1950s when teenagers start having independence because of cars, independence because of extra money, and start asserting themselves as individuals who have their own world and their own way of talking to one another that isolates themselves from the adults around them, even if the adults are sitting right next to them.
Joining my conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, he's from the University of North Dakota, where he's a philosophy professor. Each month we have a chat. We call it Philosophical Currents. And today we're talking about Jimmy Cliff's passing, which for Jack has sparked a deeper reflection on music's meaning and in and on our lives. Jack, a friend of mine has a room in his house. On his tombstone, he wants it written, "And he had a good stereo." But he has a listening room. Nobody has a listening room anymore. His is awesome. He goes there and he listens to music. He has a wonderful collection, but we're all listening to it on the run. The AirPod comes in and out. What do you mean? Okay, back in and off we go. So the way young people have access to all music nearly instantly today, is that changing the emotional bond that music for you, and I think for me, maybe had in the past?
So the listening room phenomenon is really interesting because I've known a couple people who have had exactly that. And they will not only spend tens of thousands of dollars on high-end stereo equipment, they'll also be very, very precise about where the speakers go, about where the seat goes, about how high their head should be. And the goal there, and this is philosophically really interesting, the goal there is to not just have a wonderful experience, but to reproduce the sound in exact precise quality as it would be if you were in a symphony hall or in a jazz club or playing the lute in some Shakespearean context, right, in England. And that itself is a choice because all art depends on our posture towards it. We have to ask whether we're interested in the product or the process. Is music the thing that we can play, the CD, the MP3, or is music the thing that you're playing and you're just recording? Is the job of a listener to understand completely and exactly what the composer or artist wanted you to understand, or is it to translate it to your own experience, right? We see, if you compare classical music, symphonic music, say, with jazz, symphonic music is intended to be reproduced exactly on the page with no improvisation, although the conductor will put their own stamp on it and every musician sounds a little different. If you are a master oboe listener, you will be able to identify which oboist is playing in which symphony, when to other people it sounds exactly the same thing. B.B. King's guitar playing is like that. One note, you know exactly it's him, and no one at all can reproduce it. Jazz, on the other hand, is about improvisation. Jazz is about creating something new each time and the musicians playing with one another to create something that is expressive of their ideas and their experience at the moment. And this also necessitates having a conversation about who's more important, the audience or the musicians. This comes up. I do a wonderful episode of the show with my father, actually, who's a jazz musician. It's called The Logic of Jazz. And we talk about this. We talk about the fact that for many jazz musicians, they're playing for other musicians. Britney Spears, Taylor Swift, they are not playing for other musicians. They are playing for their audience. One is not necessarily better or worse than the other. But when you are playing for an audience that is seeking to identify with the artist, to be a Swiftie, for example, then a whole bunch of other stuff comes into play. And that, again, goes back to this idea of music being central to pop culture, because it also defines the clothes that we wear. It also defines the slang that we use. It also defines who our friends are. I was about 16, and I was in a small town, New York, which is of course different than a small town in North Dakota, but a small town, New York, and I'm wearing all super punk clothes, which is what I was into at the time, and I'm walking down the street, and all of a sudden, the town punks appeared out of nowhere and crossed the street to talk to me, because here was a stranger wearing the same clothes as him. And they needed to know who I was, and they knew that I was, and this is a word that comes up very much, particularly in the 80s and 90s when you talk about this sort of thing, I was a member of their tribe. And I was someone who they knew shared an overlapped core musical and social and fashion experiences, and that was our in. And that actually has changed a lot for a variety of reasons as the technology has changed, because you and I have the experience of looking through record stores, which is a very social act, and talking to the sellers and talking to other people, flipping through the vinyl. And we had artists that we were loyal to, when we would listen to whole albums and not just songs, and a song that was, you know, a hit song off of an album felt sort of disconnected unless they were a one-hit wonder. Now, not only do young people have access to every single track ever recorded, but the youngest generation is discovering music through TikTok, where if it doesn't attract their attention in the first 3 seconds, they swipe away.
Right, frickin' now. Yep.
Yeah. And it's a fundamentally different experience, and it's predominantly visual, right? You started the question by bringing up this distinction between listening rooms and the earphones or earbuds, and the big transition which happened in the early 80s with the invention of the Walkman was the shift from this idea that music was something you did and something you listened to, and it was an activity. You know, there would be background music at restaurants and stuff, but music was an activity in and of itself, or I should say listening to music was an activity in itself. And all of a sudden it shifts from being an activity to being the background music of other activities. And your sense of what you're listening to changes, your sense of how to listen to it change. If you're in a listening room when the CDs, the digital remastered CDs of the Beatles collection was first released. I read a review that said it was amazing because you could hear Ringo's creaky pedal drum. The reproductive ability of the precise musical technology allows us to hear things. But if we're walking our dog, if we're hearing the tractor in the background, if we're doing other things, if we're reading while we're doing it, it changes the experience completely. So the folks who are vinyl collectors, on the one hand, it's just another kind of pretentious to show people that you have money and leisure. But on the other hand, it is a way of slowing things down and saying, look, we need to return to the time when listening to music was in and of itself an activity, and vinyl forces us to do that because you have to be there and you have to flip the record over 15 minutes, you know, every 15 minutes. And all of a sudden it's a return to this period, not to mention, lots of people argue that vinyl is a warmer sign and a warmer sound and has a fuller spectrum and stuff I don't know that I have an opinion on. It's incredibly complicated.
What's one piece of music, Jack, besides what we've talked about, that's also shaped your sense of self or worldview and why? And we have about 4 minutes or so left in our conversation today.
The final track of the movie version of the musical Hair, Let the Sun Shine In. The movie is an intense movie about hippies in the Vietnam War, and there's a death at the end. And the final song is this heart-wrenching, you know, clothes-tearing rendition of grief in the face of hope. And I cannot listen to it and do anything else. I have to listen to it, and it holds my heart in its hand. And I can't listen to other versions. The original Broadway soundtrack doesn't do it for me. It for whatever reason, it is that movie version. It is that track.
Do you think that you're open, that we can remain open as we age to have those similar experiences, maybe reshape us, maybe reset us a little bit?
I'd like to think so. It is harder. And part of why it's harder is I have less opportunity to discover these things, and I've dedicated less time to it. But the flip side is, one of the things that I have managed to do is stay very connected to my daughter and her musical taste. And so she will send me things all of the time, and I have a playlist of music that she has suggested to me. Especially there was a period when she was very into a band called 21 Pilots, and I have a bunch of 21 Pilots songs in this playlist, and I feel very intimately connected to them. I've seen them twice in concert, and it was incredible, but it is evocative of my relationship with my daughter, and I will never ever listen to that music without having Adina next to me, even if she's not next to me. And that's, again, connected to the way that I experienced music as a teen. But now, in order to do it, I have to break through all of my adult stuff, and I have to hold on to the thing that is the most important thing to me in the entire world, which is my daughter. And then that music can do for me what listening to the Sex Pistols does for me, or the Clash, or the Toasters, right? Ska and hardcore punk are for me the core of my younger musical identity as genres, as communities, as subcultures. And I'm never, ever, ever going to develop anything like that again. It's just not how it works.
I always feel, after today's conversation, I think I'm wrong, that sitting and listening to music is kind of a waste of time. I need to be doing something else. And perhaps now I've rethought that. My guest has been Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Our conversation began with Jimmy Clough, who just passed away today, but it really became about us, about how music creates meaning in our lives and why those early songs stay with us. You can hear more from Jack on his monthly philosophy program available here at Prairie Public. Jack, thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you to you. And I will just add, attending to art is never a waste of time. It is one of the most human things that we can do. And happy Thanksgiving to you and all of our listeners who celebrate it.
Thank you.
You just heard Jack Russell Weinstein and our own Craig Blumenschein talking about the power of music, the topic of which was prompted by the passing of reggae legend Jimmy Cliff. And do yourself a favor, aside from listening to his awesome catalog of groundbreaking reggae and crossover hits, Jimmy starred and did most of the music for the Jamaican outlaw tale The Harder They Come. You should watch it. It's a great movie. I highly recommend. On a personal note, I had the pleasure of meeting and introducing to a festival crowd Jimmy Cliff a number of years ago. It was a career highlight, to say the least. Super nice guy. Coming up in the second half, a trip to the grocery store results in some haggling over the price of a rare holiday bird. That personal story courtesy of the Tell Fargo's live monthly storytelling event. It's another good one. Stick around for that. And we'll keep the theme of music flowing today. You'll definitely want to sign up your kid for rock school after hearing the story of an all-girl Minnesota rock band and the confidence music helped bring out of them. But first, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota sits above the national average for districts participating in its farm-to-school program. An official said local success reflects the state's strong relationship with agriculture and how it's often linked to education. The Foundation for a Healthy North Dakota brought together partners for a recent update on the program. Nearly 80% of school food authorities around the state take advantage of resources to make it easier for them to buy farm-fresh food from local producers. Here's that story now from Mike Moan.
The Foundation for a Healthy North Dakota brought together partners for a recent update on the program. Nearly 80% of school food authorities around the state take advantage of resources that make it easier for them to buy farm fresh food from local producers. The North Dakota Department of Public Instruction's Amanda Olson says it isn't just beef, poultry, and milk.
We have a lot of great local bakeries in some of our smallest towns that a lot of people are purchasing the dough and then they're baking it themselves.
But there are challenges, including the winter months limiting local food production. Olson points to survey data from the USDA, which shows nearly a third of schools reported limited availability of foods grown or raised locally. The state is educating districts on the best ways to find nearby vendors and simplify purchases. Officials say the program also offers learning opportunities like school gardens. Mara Fleischman leads the Chef Ann Foundation, which awards grants to school districts across the country, including those in North Dakota, as they try to use fresh ingredients in their lunch offerings. She says there's a goal to win over skeptics in helping lunch staff to cook from scratch.
When you start moving to more freshly prepared meals, scratch-made meals, you're really kind of surrounded by this ethos then that you're able to change. So you are able to affect the health of the meal, right?
She says part of the foundation's focus is helping lunch directors create long-term plans with this approach. However, recent swings in federal funding for local grower efforts are complicating the situation. Earlier this year, the Trump administration froze a host of grants covering multiple agencies. A federal judge ordered some USDA grants to be restored. The agency typically sets aside some money for farm-to-school initiatives. This is Mike Moan for Prairie News Service.
And a national survey from Main Street America found nearly half of 1,300 small business owners experienced a drop in profits this fall. The smallest businesses with fewer than three full-time employees said they were less confident heading into the holiday season. Michael Poe is Main Street America's senior director of research and says declining revenue and profit were driving factors. But participants also pointed to tariffs, a government shutdown, and shifts in consumer spending. Poe says he hopes the instability lets up.
And that these small business owners and many times small communities start to have an expanding sense of control around their environment and that, you know, these places continue to thrive. I'm confident they will in the long run, but how much hurt on the way there?
He says the holiday shopping season is a pivotal time for many Main Street businesses. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans. You are listening to Main Street on the Monday before Thanksgiving. I'm Eric Dethridge, and for Craig this week, it's a pleasure to be with you. On the way, a Turkey Day story, not about a turkey, but a bird of a different kind. But first, if you caught UND philosophy professor Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein earlier in the hour about the power of music, we've got another story on that kind of wavelength. It's about a rockin' regional band that'll make you want to sign your kids up for School of Rock. Their story comes from Twin Cities non-commercial community station KFAI.
In Plymouth, Minnesota, I'm Ryan Dawes. I'm in a basement with a surf punk trio.
Or a leaf boy. Yeah.
The drummer's dad is just doing a little yard work outside.
We're having an interview!
What?
We're interviewing right now and you're ruining it. Thank you.
Yeah!
It's already ruined.
Hi, I'm Emily.
I'm Grace.
And I'm Jane.
And we're Last Import!
Emily sings and plays guitar, Grace plays bass, and Jane is the drummer.
Pretty much everything that we've ever listened to, which can range from Insane Clown Posse to Brian Wilson.
Like, we want to bring a fun dance party, but also kind of like, you know, people wearing some combat boots, like you might get a kick in the teeth, but it'll still be a fun surfy beach party, you know?
All three are just 20 years old, but they've been playing together since they were kids. They met through an organization called She Rock, She Rock.
She Rock, She Rock is a nonprofit organization that empowers women through music.
What they do is provide musical training and classes to young people, girls, gender nonconforming, transgender, just to kind of build confidence in music. They teach instruments there, but they also teach like self-defense and marketing and kind of stuff to be aware of in the media and the portrayal of women in media.
Jane and Grace now teach their respective instruments for the nonprofit. She Rock training and classes are offered throughout the year and at a roving summer camp called GRR.
GRR is Girls Rock and Roll Retreat, so it happens every summer with She Rock. And basically it's where a group of young girls, young women come together and they're placed in different bands and they get to do different workshops. And at the very end, there's a showcase.
GRR has a distinct culture designed to instill confidence and community among the young women. For example, girls there are discouraged from saying, "I'm sorry."
If you play a note wrong or something, you say, "I rock," and everyone's like, "You rock." And then you just yell it. But yeah, it's just super fun. We like cover all the mirrors and write nice things about inner qualities on them. And
so we try not to compliment each other on just, you know, superficial things like, "Oh, I love your new haircut," or stuff. We try to be more like, "Oh, I love that riff you played in class. I love this and that." So taping up the mirrors just kind of adds to that, focusing on more like your talents and your skills.
These skills honed through She Rock have helped them work their way up from the coffee shops and house parties they played as teenagers to headlining at premier venues throughout the Twin Cities, and even opening at the famed First Avenue. But the ladies of Last Import still meet some skeptics.
Yeah, there was one time we played at a brewery and a guy came up to us afterwards and was like, "Wow, I really thought you guys were gonna suck, but you did good." And that's what he said to us. And we're like, "Thanks,
I guess. It's a compliment." Yeah, I really enjoy proving people wrong. Sometimes, like, you know, people do have these expectations. Three young girls, like, "Oh, they're cute. Their set will be cute. Like, it'll be fun." But they don't expect us to rock that hard. And then to kind of, like, change people's minds like that is really eye-opening. And it kind of feels like you're conquering something.
I had no prior guitar training, but I taught myself guitar. I felt like I was good, but I was afraid I wasn't good enough for other people. So as a young girl, I was incredibly insecure, and to have words of encouragement like "you rock," that's made such a difference. because it's so easy, and I know I was like this, for young girls to feel like they're just not good enough, but to realize that you're an individual and you can craft something unique, and altogether you can create something that can really move people and make them dance and make them happy. That's the difference that She Rock made for me. You'll be my brother,
not by blood sugar, but by... For KFAI, I'm Ryan Dawes in Plymouth, Minnesota. The choices, they tell me
why. Hope you enjoyed that nice, inspiring story from KFAI in the Twin Cities. I'm Eric Dethridge and for Craig Blumenschein. Up next, a story about a holiday bird, but not the one you're thinking of. Stay tuned. The Bush Foundation, in partnership with Strengthen ND, announces the 2025 Bush Prize North Dakota honorees. The Bush Prize is an annual award that celebrates organizations that are highly valued within their communities and have a strong track record of successful community problem solving. The 2025 Bush Prize North Dakota honorees are TNT Kids Fitness and Hip Hop and Hope. More information about the honorees can be found online at strengthenND.com. It's Main Street for this Monday before Thanksgiving. I'm Eric Dethridge and for the vacationing Craig Blumenschein this week. So you've probably heard of a Christmas goose, right? But what about a Thanksgiving goose? Definitely a rarer bird, but not for R.C. Stein, who told his Thanksgiving shopping story in front of a live audience at the Tell Show in Fargo earlier this month. He proves what I often say about witnessing little successful moments when raising a child. Take the win.
This is kind of a Thanksgiving story. When my parents would talk about the holidays, they would never talk about having a Thanksgiving turkey or a Christmas turkey. It was a goose. That was what they ate. That's what they had back at that time, because they would raise geese on the farm, but nobody raised turkeys. So here a couple years ago, come Thanksgiving, I decided, you know, I'm gonna go buy a goose and make a goose for Thanksgiving. And so I started looking around, and boy, I have a devil of a time finding a goose in this town, you know? So I finally found one at one of the Hornbacher stores. So I bought this goose, and it was an 11-pound goose, and it was somewhere between $10 and $11 a pound. So it cost me right around $100 for the goose. So it was kind of an important thing for me to do, you know. It was kind of a nostalgic thing, and my parents are both gone, and it was just a fun thing to do. And so I made the goose. I was so excited about making the damn goose that, honest to God, it was frozen, so I had to take it out and thaw it out in the refrigerator, and that took like 3 days. And so I was, you know, kind of fretting about this goose, and I'm thinking, oh, geez, Thursday's coming up, so I got to take the goose out on Monday. I took it out the Monday before I was supposed to take it out. And so I realized I was early on this, you know, so I thought, well, you know, I can't put it back in and refreeze it anymore, so I got to make this goose. So the goose was done a week before Thanksgiving. But that was okay, because the goose turned out really, really well. And I shared it with my daughter and her family, and we just had a great time, you know, and there were leftovers for the following week, you know, and it turned out great. So a year or two later, I decided, you know, I want to make another goose. So I started looking for a goose, and again, it was hard to find it. And I finally went down to Osgood Hornbacher's. I called them, and they said, yes, we have geese. So I went to the store, and, you know, I was planning, I knew it was going to be expensive, but I walked in and kind of roundabout, like I was stalking this goose or something. I took a roundabout way back to the, in the store, and I got back to the frozen food section, and something happened that shocked me. A guy walked up and said, can I help you find something? That never happens in grocery stores. And there was a bin with about 4 or 5 geese in there. And I said, well, I'm thinking about buying a goose. He says, you know, you should buy it now. If you ever shop Hornbacher's, they got these little automated things for the prices now that they can change with a computer. And he said, the tag on that goose right there is $12 a pound. The little electronic one said $16 a pound. He says, if you buy that goose, they'll only charge you for the price that's on the drumstick, you know, the written tag. And I said, okay. So I talked with him a little bit more, picked up a goose, put it in the cart, went up to the front to check out, and the lady who's doing the checkout says, there's no tag on this goose. So she said, how much was it? And I said, well, there was a tag on the goose that said $12 a pound. And the goose that I thought I picked up was about $125. I said, however, the tag that showed up next to it was $16 a pound, and that goose was $169. The geese were all between 10 and 11 pounds. She says, oh. And she had rung up $12 a pound. And so she said, well, I have to get a manager. So she looked over, and there was this manager standing there, and she waved him over. She just looked at me and said, you tell him. And I said, well, this goose was marked $12 a pound, but it's had 16 on the little changeable thing. So, and that was 169. And he listened to my story. He looked at the lady who was at the checkout, and he said, okay, what I want you to do is, because he had to clear the till, so he swiped, he backed it off, and he canceled the sale for $12 a pound. And he says, okay, now I want you to put down meat, $12. And she handed me the thing, and I looked at the goose, and it said $12. And I said, ma'am, I'm sorry, but there's something wrong here. The goose was $12 a pound, not $12 for the goose. And she says, he told me $12. And I said, but I can't do that. The goose was $125 or $169, and now it's $12. And she looked at me, and she kind of leaned over, and she said, can't you just accept a gift? And I thought to myself, you know, sometimes you just got to step back and graciously say thank you. And so I did.
How could anybody ask for more? My needs are small. I buy them all at the 5 and 10 cent store. Oh, I've got plenty to be thankful for.
That was R.C. Stein's Thanksgiving Goose Story, as told at the 4 and 4 in downtown Fargo earlier this month. The Tell is Fargo's monthly live storytelling event. If you'd like a fun night out, maybe with some friends, watching brave souls recount their little personal moments in life, or maybe you've got what it takes to tell a tell story yourself, the next show at the 4 and 4 Above Side Street Grill and Pub is Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. You can find info on the Tell's Facebook page and Instagram.
This holiday season, millions of Americans will be hosting Thanksgiving dinner. In many households, one important question for guests: did you bring pumpkin pie or sweet potato pie? As Harvest Public Media contributor Chad Davis reports, while both dishes are similar, they carry different histories.
Photos and memorabilia line the walls of Old Henry Restaurant in suburban St. Louis. It's one of those restaurants with a wall of pictures of local and national celebrities. And longtime customers come to the cafeteria for soul food staples like fish, mac and cheese, and greens. When it comes to Thanksgiving pie, owner Ada Joyce Taylor and her granddaughter Adriana Black have a definite opinion.
Potato pie. Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Sweet potato pie, because I'm looking for that sweetness in a pie.
The flaky crust contains a deep orange filling made from boiled and peeled sweet potatoes. In the weeks before Thanksgiving, executive chef Tracy Stevenson and other bakers are cranking out even more pies.
Number of week, I would say that we go through at least 15 to 20 sweet potato pies. During the holiday, I would say 40 to 50.
Millions of Americans will choose between sweet potato pie or pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving dessert. Both are American staples with a starchy custard-like filling. But pumpkin pie tends to be more spice-heavy than sweet, and sweet potato pie is typically sweeter and lighter. The reasons why people choose one over the other often trace back to where the person was raised and their race. Sweet potatoes may have resonated among enslaved people because they're somewhat similar to yams, grown in West Africa, according to soul food historian and James Beard Award-winning author Adrian Miller. But he says cooking the natively grown sweet potato in a pie, that's a more European food.
So it's really the expertise of these enslaved cooks making someone something unfamiliar to them to please their slaveholders that eventually gets embraced and adopted. It's the same with things like fried chicken, you know, barbecue and all these other things that were not necessarily part of the West African food heritage.
Since then, sweet potato pie has become a hallmark of Black cuisine and common on dinner tables across the South. But it's pumpkin pie that plays a central role in our portrait of the quintessential Thanksgiving dinner. The pie dates back to the colonial period, where settlers learned how to boil or steam native pumpkins and mash them into a filling. Bruce Craig is an Illinois-based culinary historian. He says a book from 1827 by author and activist Sarah Josepha Hale is largely responsible for the dessert's connection to Thanksgiving.
She said, pumpkin pie is the American pie from our founding fathers.
But he says Hale got it a bit wrong.
The pilgrims who came to New England brought this pie with them. They didn't. It's not true, but she said so. So it became the thing. It became the Yankee pie.
36 years later, Hale convinced President Abraham Lincoln to proclaim Thanksgiving as a national holiday. And pumpkin pie remains incredibly popular to this day. At the Blue Owl Bakery in House Springs, Missouri, owner Kim Byerly and an assembly line of bakers will create all kinds of pumpkin pie variations.
These are our pumpkin gooey butter cheesecakes. So they've got like a pumpkin spice crust on the bottom and then a pumpkin pie filling with the pumpkin mousse on top and whipped cream.
When restaurant bakers like Cindy Watu takes a bite of the pie, it takes her back to her childhood.
I'm partial to the spices that are in it. It's not like so sweet. And then it just reminds me of home, of family.
And for many across the country, that's why they stick with pumpkin or sweet potato pie, because of the memories they've made when they've eaten it. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Chad Davis.
The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND. And you are listening to Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Deatherich for Craig Today. If you're listening during the 3 p.m. Central broadcast, All Things Considered is next. And when we think of caring for an aging parent, right now Gen X mostly is dealing with that, but so are increasingly millennials. A story about a focus on millennial caregivers who are trying to build their own lives is next on All Things Considered. If you're listening during the evening broadcast, it's Hidden Brain with Shankar Vedanta. Many families have stories that are told over and over at the holiday dinner table. You know those, right? Well, it turns out there are more to the stories than you might think. Listen to Hidden Brain tonight, 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for November 24th. In the 1870s, there were about 1,700 farms in the territory that became North Dakota, with farms averaging 176 acres in size. By 1910, that number had grown to over 7,000 farms, averaging 382 acres. Wheat emerged as a major crop, and the future looked rosy for farmers. On this date in 1925, reports based on international events bolstered optimistic predictions of North Dakota becoming a major wheat producer. European farmers were still trying to get back on their feet following World War I. They were not yet able to meet the food needs of people who were still in the early stages of recovery, and North Dakota farmers benefited from increased foreign markets. A report that black rust had ravaged the Argentine wheat crop resulted in an immediate increase of 5 cents per bushel for North Dakota wheat. Corn and oats also saw a surge in prices. The rosy future predicted for wheat producers did not last long. In 1925, the president of North Dakota Agricultural College warned that state farmers could not compete with foreign wheat producers without major changes. Dr. John Coulter said North Dakota's average wheat yield per acre was slightly over 10 bushels per acre, while the average for other producers was more than 15 bushels, and some countries were even higher. Canada produced 18 bushels per acre. Dr. Coulter advised farmers to adopt a program of crop rotation to increase yield. He said North Dakota had been farmed for over 50 years, and the land is no longer in the new, rich, cheap, clean period. Farmers would have to make changes if they wanted to remain profitable. Coulter pointed out that European farmers were recovering from the war and embracing mechanization and new farming techniques. They were beginning to produce at pre-war levels. North Dakota farmers, he warned, would fall behind if they resisted modernization. As the world slid into the Great Depression, conditions for farmers deteriorated. A disastrous economic period combined with a disastrous drought forced many off the land. North Dakota farmers did not begin to recover until the late 1930s, thanks to government programs, improved methods of farming, and an increased demand for agricultural products during World War II. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster from Prairie Public. Life moves fast, and sometimes we fall behind. Missing out on community events, stories, the news.
It isn't just a crisis during the federal shutdown, right? This is a persistent issue that we're seeing in our community.
But that's why we're here. Not just reporting to you, but reporting for you. And in so many ways, about you.
People should be aware that winter's coming. Get that winter preparedness kit ready in your car. Get the snow brush out.
We want you to feel like the news isn't separate from your day. It's connected to it. Because your stories are our news. Prairie Public. It's news that lives where you do.
Well, that about wraps it up for this Monday edition of Main Street. I'm Eric Detheridge in for Craig Blumenschein this week. Hope you'll join me tomorrow. I'll be speaking with Numuso Diane. She will become the first female commercial pilot in the history of the West African country of Mali. She is earning her wings at the University of North Dakota, and I'm delighted to bring you that conversation. Join me tomorrow on Main Street, 3 and 7 p.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening.